from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning. This is What's Next from Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. I am executive producer Charles Gilbert. Kind of weird sitting in this space alongside who I've said is the voice of What's Next, Jay Moran.
Well, thanks for saying that. I do appreciate that, Charles, for sure. But I also appreciate the chance to have a conversation here because What's Next is going through some fairly significant changes, not the least of which is a bit of a, not a time shift, but a day shift, right? So we're going to be hearing What's Next now. New programs, Mondays and Wednesdays
yes.
at 10 in the morning.
Yes.
All right. So 10 in the morning, we're familiar with that. It's been What's Next pretty much since it's started 3+ years ago. So let's get into maybe what is behind this. What's behind the move and what are we going to see come from this change a little bit? Because there's a change in style. There's going to be a change in format to a certain extent.
Yes. So every Monday, we will have a new format. We will have what is we deem the news magazine style,
okay.
which is going to be a series of stories, reports from the reporters, from our guest host that we've had on in previous What's Next episodes, kind of taking a bunch of those small stories and putting them in one show.
Okay.
What I've told, you know, reporters here is if you have a story that we only have that 2 to 5 minutes to tell their story.
That you're normally here on the air, right?
Yes, that you're normally here on Morning Edition or All Things Considered. If you feel like there's more real estate there, if you feel like there's more that you wanted to get out, if it fits the model of What's Next, if it fits the message behind What's Next, we have the platform now for you to extend that story.
Now, of course, What's Next was on a bit of hiatus there for a portion of the summer. So some folks may have missed Monday's program. Monday's program was an example of that.
That was an example of it when we did a breakdown of the One Big Beautiful Bill, where we had reports from Alex Simone, we had Jamal Harris Jr., we had Emily Watkins, Holly Kirkpatrick. They all contributed to it. But then we had kind of what we are getting now with a closer look on Thursdays, where we decided to then sit down with you and you give that in-depth behind the scenes with the reporter on how they got to the story or what their takeaways from their reportings were.
Yeah, I thought it was an enlightening conversation with, you know, Jamal and Alex. Emily Watkins stood out a little bit to me because it just seemed like there was so much in what she was talking about how Medicaid cuts are going to impact a lot of the disability community, which Emily will point out to you is a large part of this community in general.
Yes.
Kind of gets lost. So again, that's one of those types of things. Maybe you don't hear that in the report that's on the air during Morning Edition or All Things Considered, or even on the piece that you might find at btpm.org/news. You can get into, you're going to hear us talk more about some of the more expansive things when it comes to these stories. So we're definitely looking forward to more programming like that.
Yes, we are. And I always wanted to just let everybody know with this change, with the Monday format change, the mission is still the same.
Okay.
The mission is always going to be to amplify the voices of underrepresented and marginalized communities across West New York and Southern Ontario. Having those deeply rooted and sometimes uncomfortable conversations like we just did earlier today when we were recording this, we spoke with Julie Palmer from Path of West New York.
Yeah, Julie, if you haven't heard her on a previous episode, is involved in fighting against human trafficking here in Western New York. And it is a startling conversation. It was interesting because she was here part to talk about their 10-year gala that they have coming up, which is a celebration. It's a celebration of the work they've done and a celebration of the people they've helped and how they have helped to transform lives. But like you said, it gets uncomfortable because when you really start breaking it down, you talk about the fact that human trafficking is not something that happens over there or out there. It happens a lot here in Western New York to young people, 16, 17-year-olds. And I will quote Julie Palmer, it doesn't matter about whether it's a person in poverty or a person who's living in affluence. It happens everywhere. And like you said, very uncomfortable situations, talking about people that were trapped in car trunks for 3 days, trapped, locked in hotel bathrooms. Uncomfortable for sure. Appreciate having a chance to help others amplify their stories here on What's Next.
Yeah, and that's always been the mission with the show, you know, since its inception, is to have those conversations, to shed light, and to somehow, at the end of it, find that silver lining, find that hope. And that's what we're trying to do, even with the sense with this news magazine style, where you are going to hear a whole bunch of different stories. But at the end of this show, we want to have something that is going to be something of a positive, because not everything should be doom and gloom.
Sure.
You know, we obviously we're living in a world and society where every time you go and you turn on the news, it's just something that just gets you where you just don't want to be bothered with it anymore. We want to create something with this new style where it's like, okay, at the end of it, let's do something that is going to be more on a positive note, like we're going to be doing next week when we air the Hispanic Heritage, the start of the Hispanic Heritage Month.
That's just one of the examples. And again, like you said, it's not, these aren't things that maybe we didn't, that we did, we touched upon previously, but now there's going to be a little different flow to it.
Yes. Yes. There is going to be a different flow to it. We will, like I said, teasing it, you know, for next week. Next week starts the beginning of Hispanic Heritage Month. So Monday is going to be kind of all dedicated to Hispanic Heritage Month, with going to El Bate, the Puerto Rican Community Center, getting some conversations within the community there, and just kind of shedding light to that. And then obviously Wednesday, which is our traditional What's Next, we sit down with Talia Rodriguez.
So a lot ahead here on What's Next. You're the executive producer. I'm looking forward to following your lead, Charles Gilbert.
Yes, yes.
Always a pleasure to share space with you. And it's great also to kind of get you out from behind that fourth wall, so to speak, and be out here talking about what's happening here. Of course, we're talking, we're kind of focusing a little bit on changes in format, but at the same time, it's a great opportunity to perhaps preview the types of conversations that we're going to hear as we move forward. And we're going to actually have a nice segment coming up here with a couple of individuals who we've talked to who are focused a lot on education.
Yes. So we did sit down over the summer when we were gathering all our new interviews. We sat down with LeGarrette King from the University of Buffalo and Duncan Kirkwood, who is an educator himself, to kind of go over just what's been going on. LeGarrette King had his recent conference that you went to one of them in the past.
Yeah, I went to the first one. The first one was held over at City Honors a couple of years back. It was new to the University of Buffalo, and it's all focused on bringing in, you know, teachers from not just around Western New York, but all over the country, for that matter, who come in, and whether, A, they want to learn more about how Black history is being taught in the classroom, or B, talk about how they teach Black history in the classroom. And it really, I really enjoyed what I had a chance to see because, and I think, Charles, you can lay claim to this understanding. When it comes to teaching Black history, the reality is it's been kind of segregated. I apologize for using that word, but it's been somewhat segregated to just 1 month of the year.
Yes, it has been. And I am one of those people that feel like it should be yearly taught.
It's American history.
Yes, it is American history. And we are seeing that a lot of cities, a lot of states are trying to get rid of it. But people like LeGarrette King, who has his conference, who teaches the history, our history, mm-hmm. is really pivotal, especially with him teaching it to the youth and how the youth has big influence on the history of us, of our people.
And he also gets a little bit into just kind of how at the same time there's this, like you were saying, there's a pushback. It almost seems like it's from the federal level to almost shrink the amount of education that is being delivered around the country, which is notably troubling in its own regard.
It is very noticeably troubling, but this is why we do what we do here, because we want to continue to push for our history, our stories to still be told. And LeGarrette does a phenomenal job at explaining how the conference helped usher that in.
And then we've got two interesting guests here in this next segment. We've got LeGarrette King, we talked about. You know, LeGarrette is a scholar. Duncan Kirkwood is a brilliant individual. He may call himself a scholar, I don't know, but at the same time, he has more of a grassroots approach, but he is in classrooms. He is in school districts, and not just in the city of Buffalo. He is all over the country in big districts, small districts, districts that in some cases may not even have a Black individual inside.
That is true. I remember when you were sitting with him and doing the conversation, and it was one of those moments where I wish that I could have jumped in on the conversation, mm-hmm. because he did mention how, I believe it was, he was visiting a school in Utah,
mm-hmm.
and they never seen a Black kid.
Right.
And they have, you know, obviously being out there, there's certain stigmas that gets brought upon when they just see what they see on the news and how the media portrays Black people. And when he basically broke it down, it was like, you know, we're not all this way. We are educated. We're, you know, some people have businesses. Some people are entrepreneurs. Some people are, you know, wealthy. But you won't see that because of what you're seeing on television.
Right. And it's interesting, though, as he goes through this process, and he teaches what he calls resiliency. And resiliency has no color, right? I mean, kid, every person needs to be resilient. But what is interesting about his relationships with these school districts, here he's coming in, he's bringing a whole different, in some cases, a whole different viewpoint on the world into districts. These districts are welcoming him back. His message is resounding in these places. And that, you talked about hope in the last segment, that is the type of thing that gives me hope.
Yes, because what he does is he's one of the people that the late, great Tupac talked about, of being the spark ignites the change. He's one of those people that is, with his resiliency program, he is igniting that change. He is creating that spark. He is opening people's eyes to the reality that we're not all what the media portrays us to be. You're about to hear from both LeGarrette King and Duncan Kirkwood right here on What's Next from Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR.
One of the things that does keep you busy, and we've had a chance to talk about this in the past, is your annual Teaching Black History conferences. You had your 8th this summer. Let's maybe just touch upon how things went for you.
Yeah, so the 8th Teaching Black History Conference, I believe this was the fourth one we had here in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. Our theme this past year was Black Boy Joy, Black Girl Magic, the History of Black Childhoods.
Okay.
And I think that's real interesting and, you know, something that we don't really get into in terms of Black education.
Right.
Is the contributions of children and how they influence history, right? Whenever we kind of think about social change and social justice, typically who leads us are our children, right? You know, those who are, you know, 25 and under. And so this conference was in honor of them, right? So we had around 189 people come and visit us at UB downtown at the medical center. And we had 3 days of, you know, wonderful networking presentations, as well as other, you know, activities that engaged us in the concept of Black history education.
I'm fascinated about the, like you said, the contribution of Black children. Mm-hmm. to the history. Let's talk about that a little bit, because, you know, obviously you didn't set up that title if there wasn't a lot of substance there. Mm-hmm. And there has been probably a certain amount of scholarly work on it. There's probably so much you could tell us about what we don't really know, but what were some of the takeaways from the conference?
Yeah, I think one important aspect of kind of understanding how children have contributed to, you know, history. A lot of times when I may say that, people may kind of just picture, you know, Black children getting, you know, sprayed by the water hoses down in, you know, Alabama during the Civil Rights Movement. But in many ways, when I'm thinking about this notion of Black boy joy, Black girl magic, are not necessarily the painful things that had occurred towards Black children in kind of this, you know, approach to freedom, but just the everyday kind of understandings of how Black children use their agency and how Black children use their creativity and how Black children, you know, survive during, you know, particularly difficult times, right? So take, for instance, something that we don't really talk about when we talk about the history of slavery, right? Are kind of the children and how they kind of connected and stayed children, right? So, you know, the history of toys that enslaved children, you know, created, right? You know, you'll see, you know, enslaved children creating certain dolls or certain type of what we would call board games or tic-tac-toe, or all these particular things are like very interesting to kind of say, well, during this kind of historic time, right, that we all have kind of connected with oppression, right? You know, Black children found a way to still be children, right, during those particular aspects of life. But yeah, but learning about, you know, Black kids and, you know, how they did certain things throughout history, I think is like extremely important for people to understand.
And to take that then, when it comes to understanding history and how you as a historian go about, and your fellow historians go about, you know, gathering and understanding it yourselves, you know, what types of materials are you utilizing when you try to dig deeper into this topic?
Yeah. So for, you know, the historians, you know, I like to call myself kind of a Black history educator.
That's true. That's true. I gave you probably not, you know, the right historian, exact title. Right? That's right. Right.
So while I know probably more history than the average person, mm-hmm. right, I wouldn't kind of connect myself as a historian going into the archives and,
right.
you know, trying to find original, you know, artifacts to kind of study and learn and piece things together. Right. So a historian kind of takes these different aspects and pieces of story together, right? Particularly primary sources, right? So, you know, more for educators, however, you know, a Black history educator, we do take those primary sources, but then also we utilize a lot of secondary sources to kind of, you know, help us kind of teach those things that these historians have kind of connected, right?
I go talk to kids. I'm trying to talk to the Duncan in the audience that's 16, that has potential, that could be something great, but just doesn't care right now. So I'm trying to be as vulnerable and as authentic and sharing in what I've gone through and where I am now, so they can see, like, listen, you kid right there can actually make a good living, live out your dreams, do something you love, and have fun and make money. And here's what it looks like to make money. You know what I'm saying? I go to some schools, they be like, oh, you play ball? No, I'm an author. And they're all confused. They're like, what? Yeah, I'm an author. Here, your school bought 400 books. Here they go. I'm going to be signing them afterward. You know what I'm saying? Like, and so it changes it. Oh, like, oh, you're an author? you're a speaker, you were in the military. Like all of us, all these perceptions they had when I walked in, they're like, oh, he look cool. Look at his sneakers. You know, cause I come in with like jewelry on, sneakers, all of that stuff. And they're like, oh, he look cool. Then it's like, no, I write books. You know, I train educators and principals, and it just totally exposes them to a different experience of what it could look like to be Black and successful, not just what they see on TV. And that's helpful for kids that are not Black too. Like when I go to, you know, South Jordan in Utah, those kids ain't never seen a Black man that's educated and successful.
Right.
So for them, it's helpful too to give another version of what the Black experience can look like, or what just a successful person can look like who's been through stuff, because everybody's been through stuff, and they can, it helps them in their development as well.
I want to get into a lot of those conversations, whether it's in the city of Buffalo, South Jordan, in Utah, or wherever. I think you've got some interesting insights, and we want to get back to it. I just want to get back to just one more thing about Buffalo kids, because it's I love that when people can put this into words. But you also talked about the edge that Buffalo kids have. Tell me about the edge that Buffalo kids have.
So I think that one thing people don't take into account with our kids is, and Black people in general, people think that Black people are inherently violent. Okay. That is not true, but a lot of people do believe that. Okay. And because of that, when they see Black kids with this toughness, they think that's part of that narrative of them being inherently violent. And what they miss is the edge comes from, I have to have the edge for my own safety. Right. Because there are criminals in all colors, all communities. Right. So there are criminals in Black communities, white communities, Hispanic communities, whatever. So in Black communities, though, you live close to criminals. You got to be ready to defend yourself. You have to have friends and a group that can keep you safe. So the edge comes from perpetually living in a place that's unsafe, where you don't feel safe. Right. So then on top of the physical violence, you also are being taught by people who don't speak your language, who don't understand your culture, who don't look like you. So now you're being constantly overly disciplined, talked to in a way that you don't feel is fair or lifting you up. So now that edge boils over into this. And also you behind in reading. So you're also 2-3 grades behind in reading. So now you're embarrassed to have to read or try and do assignments for them to say it's not good enough or you're behind. Right. So now there's an edge there where it's like, well, I don't care. Then forget it. Mm-hmm. Right. Because it hurts more to try your best and be told you're not good enough, or it's not, you know, you're not where you need to be, than to just say, screw it, I don't care, and try the minimum. Because now when you fail, you're like, well, I didn't try anyway. So all of that kind of comes together. And again, not all Buffalo kids, just so we clear.
No.
There are lots of Buffalo kids that are doing the right thing in leadership organizations, you know, getting good grades, college. So
there's, but at the same time, they probably also have a bit of an edge too, just because of the realities that you were just talking about.
Right. And what we glamorize in Black culture is also what our kids mimic. So the people they listen to have this toughness and this, I will fight, and da, 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 da. So they have that energy because they're consuming that type of media every single day. Mm. So you put all that together, and then you put them in front of people in a school district where the people who are educating them don't understand that, they don't speak that language, they don't come from the same neighborhoods. So it's like causing this headbutting, this rift, where these professionals who are experts at teaching don't get to really teach because they got to fight through this edge that they got to deal with from 27 kids every day, you know what I mean, every hour. So it's a tough situation. But there are some, like, this is one social studies teacher at school 59. I sat in his class because I'm doing one of my youth programs there. And I was in his class because I had some extra time. And he was cooking. He's a white guy. And he was talking about the British coming. And he was talking about muckrakers. And he was breaking it down to the kids when he has so much energy. These little middle school kids, he was like, okay, so what's a muckraker? They raising their hand. They, you know, talk about the journalists. What's this? Like, and it was like all of this part of American history and stuff to learn. But because of his energy, because he was working to connect with them, they were getting it. So it is possible, and there are great shining spots all across our district.
That was LeGarrette King and Duncan Kirkwood right here on What's Next from Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR. I am executive producer Charles Gilbert, sitting alongside with the voice, Jay Moran.
Charles, great to be with you, and great to hear those conversations again as well. Coming up here with another segment, and We've got George Nicholas and Samantha Hidalgo. They'll be with us in just a little bit, and also Carolyn Kirkwood. And I want to talk about the Carolyn Kirkwood conversation for a moment. Among the changes that are on the program, you're going to be more involved from behind that glass window, behind that fourth wall.
I'm breaking the fourth wall.
You're going to break the fourth wall, and you did it in this conversation.
Yes, I did. So, little baseball conversation. Our senior director of audio strategy, SJ Vasquez, has always stated to me, and it's not just her, even people, the previous regime that we had, wanted to hear more from me, mm-hmm. wanted to hear more of me engaging in the conversations. People know what I do outside of the job here, and they kind of just wanted to just poke. They kept trying to poke. You know?
Right.
I remember, Jay, when I first started here, you were kind of like, yeah, we're gonna get you.
We'll get you in.
We're going to get you in. And now it is, you know, that's what we've done. You know, mm-hmm. we've done it in a sense where it's kind of like how if you watch any podcast or you hear any show and you hear the producers come on and they may have like their two cents or want to contribute more mm-hmm. to it. That's kind of what we're doing here.
And, you know, Charles, despite the changes that are coming up here, I know you're committed to this for sure. And the show remains committed to focusing on its origins, which are not losing sight of its origins, which, of course, is the racist massacre on the Jefferson Avenue Tops, 5/14/2022. This show emerged less than 2 weeks after that. And we've been focusing a lot on conversations revolving around that, but we've expanded. And we're going to expand here as well. But I wanted to bring this back to the idea of what you bring to this program, where you come from, your experience, and why I think people should be excited about hearing more from you as we move forward in these programs.
Well, for those that don't know my origin story here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media, I started being the board op, but I was, and I've said it in our anniversary shows, mm-hmm. I was present the day the shooting took place.
Right
up the block from there. I was at the Beverly Gray Exchange.
You can see Tops from the, the window.
I could see it. I've told the story, Jay, you've heard it countless times. My best friend happened to go outside to grab something because we were creating content. He happened to go out there and I happened to look out the window and seen the ambulance. And I kind of just was like, what's going on? I called him up and he said that he's seen the shooter.
Mm.
And he's happened to see, you know, some of the bodies.
Mm.
And we sat there and we kind of was like, it was kind of in awe. You know, it was surreal to believe that something like this would touch home.
Right.
You know, I grew up in around that neighborhood. My mother and my godmother used to go there for lunch. My grandmother lived around the corner from there. So many things I have ties to that. And coming here, I always felt like there was a reason, there was a purpose that I was brought here. And I've always said, even with the guests that we talk to, even with people that I talk to outside, there's a reason why I'm here. As long as I am here, I'm going to continue to make sure that what's next continues its mission, continues to have those conversations, continue to be that beacon of hope, if you want to say, for not just here in West New York, but across. You know, I have big dreams that I would like to do with the show, but it's one step at a time.
In the coming segment, we have, we've mentioned George Nicholas, and Samantha Hidalgo, but also Carolyn Kirkwood. That's, we did say how that's where you breached the fourth wall, so to speak. But
yes.
But I thought what came in here is Carolyn was talking about her practice, helping people with mental health issues. And you gave some real honest feedback about your own experience.
And I think that's where and why people want to hear from me on here. Mm-hmm. Because of my experience because I kind of tell it how I see it. And that's something that a lot of people are engaged with. I remember speaking with one of our colleagues, Jerry, and he was telling me how the last episode I did with Deja Middlebrook and Shayna Brockington, how he was really engaged in that conversation because he said, and this is a point that I want to make here. Jerry, who is this older white man, felt like my story resonated with him. So that's an example of how you don't know what walks of life people are coming from. But for him to hear my story and to say, I really understood where you was coming from. And then he did tell me, and I hope he doesn't get upset for me saying this. He did say that the one thing that he was a little upset about was that I framed the question then to recenter it back on Black mental health, Black okay. men's mental health.
Right.
But I had to explain to him, we were doing this during Black Men's Mental Health Awareness Month.
Right.
So the focus is on that because there's this stigma behind not only men's mental health, but Black men's mental health. Right. And that's kind of also what I talked about with Carolyn Kirkwood as well.
I'm wondering about fronts that people put up.
Mm-hmm.
And again, how...
I'm one of them.
There we go. I don't know how that... That's Charles Gilbert joining us here. But maybe Charles and Carolyn can have this conversation then, Charles. You brought it up. You put up fronts. So you put up a front sometimes when you're talking to your therapist?
When I first started, yes, okay. I did. That's because my first therapy experience was not the best.
Okay.
It was very much, and I spoke about it on the last episode that I did, the therapist talked down on me.
Mm.
You know, like I just became a father and I'm going down this path of taking care of this responsibility that is on me and I don't know how to navigate and go through all of this. And the way he just talked to me, I walked out of there and said, I'll never do it again.
Mm.
But it was the strength of watching my daughter go through therapy. So as y'all were talking and you were talking about, you know, the children that have to go through or go through trauma, that made me think about my daughter and what she has gone through and seeing her being able to sit there and have that conversation with a therapist, never seen them a day in her life, but she's able to let her guard down and just bear all. I'm like, why can't I do it? So when I first got to my therapy session, it was very much like I was guarded. I was like, I'm got to get a feel for this person. But the one thing that my therapist told me, and I tell this to people when I speak about therapy, is my therapist told me she's just a wall. And whatever you're saying eventually is going to bounce off and hit you. And everything's going to kind of, as like Carolyn was saying, come back. Like all those things that you thought you got rid of will start to resurface. And then you'll start to remember those things. And, it really made me like this whole conversation has had me sitting back, taking notes, trying to figure out like, how can I interject? But one of the questions that I have, and this kind of goes back to the foster portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying how like the kids have to deal with these things. How do you navigate or how do you like go through that process when the kid doesn't feel like they're good enough? So like, when they are, because I know different circumstances happen, that's why kids are in foster care. But what happens when, like, you have that one that's just so adamant that, like, they don't understand why they were put here? Mm-hmm. Like, why is it that my parents don't want me?
Mm-hmm. So you have to, I think that you have to constantly affirm a child. And I'm not even just talking about a child that's dealing with their own mental health and self-esteem issues. You have to constantly affirm any child so that, because children are sponges, right? And in order for them to develop confidence and self-esteem, you always have to pour that into a child.
Right.
And so constantly reminding a child that, oh my gosh, you've done a good job. And then you have to just, every little thing that they do, thank them and praise them for it so that they know they are doing a good job, that you are doing well. And then when it comes to the parents, I always try to find a way with kid gloves on to talk to a child. And so mommy has to go to the doctor because mommy's trying to get better. She's trying to work on herself. So she asked me to watch you. Mom is my friend and we're going to hang out for a little bit. Mom trusts me to hang out with you while she goes to see the doctor so that she can get well. And you just give them just enough that makes it make sense, mm-hmm. but without like overdoing it for a child, things that they don't need to know. They don't need to know that mom's actually in rehab or mom's actually in jail or, you know what I mean? You don't have to give that level of a detail. But mom's doing so good. She's trying to work on herself because she's having a hard time. She's not really feeling well right now. So mom is asking me to hang out with you. And then I say things like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to tell your mom you did that. Your mom is going to be so proud. Oh my gosh, let's make this for mommy. And you're always going to include their parent in what they're doing so that they feel validated, not just by you, but by their parent as well. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does.
And I'm wondering, Carolyn Kirkwood, as you heard Charles talk about his initial experience, wasn't a positive one. And then, but that front,
mm-hmm.
how quick as a therapist do you pick up on that?
Well, every day, literally okay. every day. But I am a therapist, so I do this every day. So I'm very good about connecting with people on a personal level and making people feel comfortable. And one of my opening lines every time I meet a new patient, I say, this is your safe space and you're allowed to talk about absolutely anything you want here. No topic is off limits. So that includes children and finances, mental health, sex, just literally anything that you want to talk about here. This is your safe space to say without judgment. And I tell them, I said, you'll get out of therapy what you put in. So I encourage you every time you come here to be your best normal self. You don't have to use perfect language here. You don't have to use your work voice like you are at work. You don't even have to bring that person that goes to work every day because that person is already perfect. That person puts on their shirt and their tie and they go to work and they're perfect, right? Leave that person at work. I want you to be the person that you are late at night when you're in your feelings, the person that you are on an everyday basis when you wake up in the morning and, you know, when the cameras are off. That is the person that needs the work because that's the person that's not perfect. So if you need to drop a F-bomb to express yourself, you're allowed to do that here and that's okay. And I actually say that to people every single time I meet a new person. And just being able to say that really helps a person to truly like, okay, I can let my shoulders down a little bit, you know, because it's hard to use your perfect work voice to code switch while you're also talking about your innermost feelings. And so having a person that you can just be normal with just truly helps break down that barrier.
And Charles, I'm curious then about your experience. I guess, you know, you're continuing to seek therapy or you've been in therapy continuing. Do you find that experience that you and those moments can be your true self?
Now I can.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Took some time.
Yeah, it did. With my therapist, it didn't take as long as I thought it would. But I bear all to my therapist. I have cried to my therapist. I have expressed anger. There's times where I just will say, I really don't know what I'm feeling at this moment, just because it's so much that's going on. That is like, I don't know why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling. Like there's days where I will be perfectly fine. But then a split second, something happens. And then it's just like, I don't know why I feel like this now.
Right.
You know, and it's still like a lot of stuff that I have to overcome. Y'all were speaking about forgiveness. And that's something that I had to endure within the past few years with my father. And I had to come to peace with that. I had to come to peace with knowing that, hey, this is kind of what it is. Mm-hmm. I have to be able, like she said, be able to forgive for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to be able to be like, okay, I know this is not going to change. The relationship is never going to be better. So I have to be okay and accept the fact that we have gone our separate ways. So it's very challenging, even with me being in therapy for the amount of years that I've been in, just because I still, there's still like a small part of me that still has that mindset. And it's very small that I have that mindset where it's like, I shouldn't be showing this much vulnerability, you know, especially for like a man, especially for a black man, because we were always taught not to show it. I said it last time. I hate the terminology of show no love, love will get you killed. I despise that term because that's not how life should be. So that's kind of how I've taken all this.
And of course, we also have Pastor George Nicholas and Samantha Hidalgo. And that's another event that's coming up. And again, another example of how the show is going to be a little bit different. I mean, not necessarily in who is speaking, but in maybe the information and the focus upon which you're going to be hearing on what's next moving forward.
Yes. Yeah, so the message is we are focusing on people, but if they have something that's going on, like Pastor Nichols has the Igniting Hope Conference, which I went to two or three years ago. I went to one of his conferences, so I can speak on the fact of how this conference is. It's a 2-day conference, you know, went to the community event that was outside of Johnny B. Wiley that year. And then the next day was at UB Medical Campus and went there, and they had the conference and they had breakout sessions where people were going and having these smaller, intimate conversations, and really was thought-provoking and a powerful experience.
The Igniting Hope Conference comes up on Friday, September 19th and the 20th. Where are we at right now, Samantha, in terms of what we're going to expect? You know, and I guess we never really know how things are going to play out until we get the alchemy of all the participants. But what are we looking for right now?
Yeah, I think it's important to note this Igniting Hope is very different than the first 7 Igniting Hopes that we did, where we maybe chose an overarching kind of health equity issue. Last year, for instance, it was environmental justice, and we did smaller breakout groups like maternal health, access to healthy food, and saw how those two issues intersected with, you know, keynote speakers talking about environmental justice as a whole. This year, because we're doing a strategic planning session, we are within the 5 kind of topic areas that Pastor's already mentioned: access to healthy food, access to primary care, education literacy, housing, and then unemployment, spending time really developing solutions within our own community for those things. I think it's in our title, like we have to save ourselves. Like Superman isn't coming to scoop us out. And I think any right that we have or any policy that supports health equity has never just been given, right? Like we as a community have had to fight for those things, advocate for those things. And so our goal for September 20th, which is the conference, is to have time and conversation around each of those subjects. Our kind of rough agenda for the day so far is going to be welcomes. And then we're spending time in the morning and time in the afternoon to discuss all 5 of those topic areas. So attendees or participants. That's right. Yes. We're moving past attendees.
Okay.
Into
participants. Oh, yeah. Because you want everybody to, you don't just to attend. You want them to participate.
Exactly. Gotcha.
Okay.
You'll have the opportunity to attend 2 out of the 5. So if you wanted to do housing in the morning and access to primary care in the afternoon, you're more than welcome to. So we're running really 10 strategic planning sessions because we're running all 5 in the morning, coming together again, and then running all 5 again in the afternoon. And we have a really wonderful team. We've expanded our planning committee, I think, by double. This might be the largest planning committee we've ever had, which is fantastic. I think one thing I'm really hopeful for, and something that excites me about Igniting Hope, is that we'll have something tangible at the end of the day, right? We may not have everything figured out for how we're going to get there, but it's going to be a really strong foundation to then present to other community members, the region, local electeds, to say, this is what we want, and you've got to help us get it done. Am I forgetting anything?
No, I mean, and I think it's so important for us to understand. So you kind of started off the question asking us about the Buffalo Center for Health Equity.
Right.
And our role really is we're conveners. We focus on research, policy, programmatic development, community engagement. That's really our role, right? So we're not competing against many of these great organizations that are providing direct services, right? I'm trying to keep our our organization lean and really focused on creating those tables so we can have this conversation. When you think about when we started, had our first Igniting Hope 7-8 years ago and where we've come from there. Now we have the Buffalo Center for Health Equity. We're in the midst of living out our investment that Highmark made to us for 5 years, $5 million for us to lead this work. And they've been Highmark has been a great, great partner. And before Highmark made their investment, the Health Foundation of Central and Western New York and Erie County invested in capacity building for us. Two, University of Buffalo has created the UB Community Research Institute, and an institute is the highest level in the university system, and has recently hired Dr. Heather Gardner from Temple University to come and lead this work. It is funded now by a $10 million Dr. Carl Granger endowment. And to kick off the UB Community Research Institute, President Tripathi was the first one in to, you know, invest in this. So we have an academic institution. And then through the leadership at that time, Chairwoman April Baskins, when she was chair of the county legislature, with the support of the county executive, Mark Poloncarz, who was a big investor in our COVID-19 response project that was able to lower the fatalities of Black people from COVID. And we won national recognition about that. And so the county executive and at that time, April being at the county legislature, created this Office of Health Equity that is led by our great partner, Kelly Wolford. And so now we have organization that's community-based, we have an organization that's institutional or academically based, and an organization that's embedded in government through the health department. And so when people say, well, what are your outcomes? Those are three huge outcomes, right? And all three of us, our organizations work together to do some fantastic work. UB right now, we still have an NIH grant, and we're going to be doing community-based research where we're partnering with people at the neighborhood level that are partnering with academics to research topics that are important in their communities, and not only doing the research, but coming up with approaches to address the issues that we research. Again, these things aren't happening anywhere else in America but here. Erie County Department of Health Equity, if you go onto their website, you will see some of the best health equity data that, again, we would put this up against any county in this country that's really giving us the opportunity to understand the disparities and why they are happening in our community. In addition to that, some of our other partners, HealthyLink, which does all the looks about health data of about 90% of our providers in this region, they now are engaged in health disparity and looking at data to give us information about, you know, why these health disparities exist in certain communities. We partner with Partnership for Publica, PPG, right? Mm. And we're doing a project now that's looking at restorative practices for the community health responders.
We're trying to bring community responders, a non-criminal, social care needs. So if you're familiar with Daniel's Law coming out of the Rochester group, something kind of similar in that vein, when people are maybe having social needs calls that are really de-escalation and not necessarily police presence is required. Maybe somebody is homeless and needs like a ride to the homeless shelter. That would be something that we're trying to bring here to Buffalo, piloting in the 14208 zip code, and then eventually out to the whole county is our vision. And so we, through some really generous support from the state and the Bills Foundation, or just I think the Bills, are able to now hire someone to kind of coordinate that work as we kind of build out what our future plan is. But
and that was the Bills Players Committee.
Yes. That's yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. Investing in that.
I think what Pastor's saying too, and maybe echoes our own path to like being an organization, is that it's not just our local electeds that we need to be engaging. It's our research partners. It's our large institutions, because I know President Tripathi at UB, every year, whether he's there physically or not, gives an address at Igniting Hope, whether that's a pre-recorded video or he's there in person spending the day with us, right? Like, it's not just like, oh, we really want to do this. Right. And people are like, yeah, whatever. Like, people are invested in what we're doing. And I think you can see that through some of the work that we're trying to do.
Charles Gilbert, you've got me excited about what's ahead here for what's next. Always been excited to do each and every program I've been fortunate enough to be a part of, but you've given me some confidence moving forward. I most certainly appreciate that.
Yes, and this has been What's Next from Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.